Good evening. We're getting off to a good start here. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, November 23rd. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Reynolds.
Here.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Costello.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin is absent tonight. And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Next on our agenda is the flag salute. If you would please join the Knights of Columbus. Mr. Wayne Dempster is here to lead us in the flag salute and remain standing for our invocation. Gene Bowser is here from Baha'i Faith to lead us in the invocation.
Place your hand over your heart and repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good evening. In the spirit of Thanksgiving, I would like to share with you some words from four spiritual traditions. I'll start with Judaism. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who creates many living beings and the things they need. For all that thou hast created to sustain the life of every living being, blessed be thou, the life of the universe, and the sky as a canopy, and has given you shapes, and made your shapes beautiful, and has provided for you sustenance of things pure and good. Such is Allah, your Lord. So glory to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. And from the Baha'i Faith, to thank God for his bounties consisteth in possessing a radiant heart and a soul open to the promptings of the Spirit. This is the essence of Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Gene. That was a wonderful invocation. Really appreciate it. Next on the agenda is special presentation, and we do have a very special presentation this evening. It's my pleasure to step down from the dais, and with anyone who would like to join him, I would invite Mr. Salvatore Sal Federico to join me at the podium. Sal, don't tell me they didn't tell you what was going on tonight. Don't tell me they didn't tell you what was going on tonight.
No, they didn't tell me.
They didn't. What are friends for?
They keep everything a secret.
They do.
Well, it's 32 years that I've lived.
32 years they keep you in the dark.
Right.
Well, Sal, it is my pleasure this evening to present you with an honorary proclamation recognizing November 23rd, 2004, as Salvatore Sal Federico Day in the City of Arroyo Grande. And I have a proclamation here that I would like to read. Whereas Salvatore Federico immigrated to the United States of America from Alife, Italy in 1913, and whereas Salvatore Sal became a naturalized citizen on July 23rd, 1940, and whereas being too old to serve in the armed forces, he chose to support the war effort as a mechanic with McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company of Long Beach. And whereas Sal and his late wife, Ruth, moved to Arroyo Grande 32 years ago, where he served and continues to serve as an usher every Sunday at St. Patrick's Church, which is where I recognize you from. You're a fixture there.
Yeah. And built that church.
And whereas he served St. Patrick's Elementary School for many years as a bingo caller, and whereas at age 97, he is the oldest living member of the Arroyo Grande Knights of Columbus, Council 1375, having received the honors of the first degree on April 22nd, 1977. And whereas Sal also holds membership in the Sons of Italy and the Italian Catholic Federation. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, recognize and honor one of the city's oldest citizens by declaring November 23rd, 2004, as Salvatore Sal Federico Day in the city of Arroyo Grande. It's my pleasure to present this to you.
See, everybody that I have grown up with, the same as the products and things that this country puts out. I want to thank each one, every one of you, from the bottom of my mended heart. It's been mended. And I am very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
You had to say that. I'm not sure how he does it, but I think Sal knows every person who walks through that door at St. Pat's, and along with the family history. We won't go any farther than that. So. Okay, thank you for being here. Wayne, is there anything you would like to add to what Sal said? Maybe a little bit about what Knights of Columbus is doing these days? We'd appreciate a few words if you'd like to.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Believe me, I brought these with me because I've been here so often, I think you must think I'm the only Knight of Columbus in Arroyo Grande. I brought some evidence that there are more than just myself. And I want to apologize for the Grand Knight. He's in New Mexico attending a family funeral, and he would be here in my place. So he asked me to represent him tonight. As you know, we're very active, and we just finished donating $500 to the Jacqueline Palchik Fund for Cancer Research. That just happened a couple of days ago. And out of our not quite successful fireworks fund this year, we managed to scrape up $2,000 to help fund the Boy Scouts Troop 26 with new camping equipment. And so we're constantly active. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure, you bet. Thank you for being here. I bet John Silva is very happy with that addition to Troop 26. So.
His mother's right here.
Somebody's got to watch him. Okay, thank you. Thank you all for being here. And again, Sal, congratulations and our best to you. That takes us to item number 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the audience to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any formal action on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes or less, and please direct them to the council as a whole. Good evening.
Hello, everyone. Have a good evening. My name is Nuclear Plants. Would be requesting license renewal extensions, and that they were hoping that all of those would go forward. PG&E has stated that they have started feasibility studies into extending the license of Diablo Canyon. Currently, the license goes to 2025. They are granting license extensions far in advance of the license being at its due date. And in this respect, 30 nuclear power plants in the country have received license extensions. In addition to this, a federal court just ruled last summer that the original design of some of the criteria for Yucca Mountain was inadequate to fully shield human civilization as thoroughly as it should have. And a lot of that is going through the process now, but Yucca Mountain has basically been stalled. Locally, our dry cask storage, or ISFISI, our ISFISI plans for Diablo Canyon have gone through the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission. They're now at the Public Utilities Commission awaiting a ruling there. There is significant concern, even if Yucca Mountain opens, on two fronts. One is the transportation of nuclear waste through urban zones, and secondly, the that even if Yucca Mountain opens, there may not be adequate space for the nuclear waste, the high-level radioactive waste from Diablo Canyon. The conclusion I'm trying to come to with all of this is that we may be stuck with this nuclear waste forever, or for the foreseeable future at least. And therefore, the Mothers for Peace are bringing to you a resolution tonight, which will be read by my colleague, asking that we reconsider the previous resolution, and the new one has a little bit stronger language, asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission not to allow a license extension on Diablo Canyon. America has 77,000 tons of highly radioactive waste that we have no place for except in communities like our own. I know we need the electricity. I am not saying that. Diablo Canyon is aging. It's been requested that $706 million be used to replace steam generators. I did a rough calculation, and it's not perfect, but it gives me a rough idea. Approximately half the homes in San Luis Obispo County could be made solar just for the price of replacing the steam generators. So I'm asking us to look for providing for our energy needs in alternative sources, looking to the future. And I know your part in that might be small, but it's something to keep in mind.
It could not be granted by the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, under its current standards and regulations. And whereas after the events of September 11th, 2001, the possibility of more powerful and more precise weapons in the wrong hands must be taken into consideration, and Diablo and all nuclear plants with on-site highly radioactive waste are prime targets for acts of terrorism or war. And whereas such an attack or a severe accident could render much of the county uninhabitable for generations and cause thousands of casualties, and such continuous threats are intolerable to the people of San Luis Obispo, and whereas the eventual transportation of the high-level radioactive waste to a permanent location is undetermined, yet will likely utilize truck, rail, and barge, and will indisputably add additional risks to those on the transport route. And whereas, as Connie mentioned, other cost-competitive and less risky energy options are increasingly available and encouraged in current state directives, and whereas it is the responsibility of this lawmaking body in the interest of public health and safety to call on the NRC to reject any applications for license renewal for the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant until issues of new seismic information, high-level radioactive waste storage, safe transportation to a permanent safe storage site, security, aging components, mitigation for damage to the marine environment, and cost-benefit alternatives are resolved. Therefore, be it resolved that the City of Arroyo Grande opposes any relicensing, generic or specific, of Diablo Canyon Units 1 and 2 until issues of the above stated concerns are resolved. And be it resolved that the City of Arroyo Grande urges the NRC to prohibit Diablo Units 1 and 2 from being relicensed and to make this finding as soon as possible so that all concerned and involved parties can devote their can devote their time conducting a cost-benefit analysis of continued nuclear operation and devote their resources to finding alternatives to the existing nuclear power plants. I also have a copy of the resolution that was adopted by the County of San Luis Obispo, the Board of Supervisors. So you have both of those for your records. Where can I submit those?
Steve, you want to take that copy of that? Or Kelly?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. Marie Couture, 195 Orchid Lane. I hope that you gentlemen will accept this resolution and put it on your next agenda and support it. The world isn't the same as it was when this plant was licensed, and the dangers increase. When last December, when you did support the resolution that you passed, you did say that regardless of what mitigation measures were taken at the plant, 2003 report, PG&E's CEOs were paid, their compensation for the year was $10,517,611, or an average for a 260-day work year, $40,452 a day. The U.S. Department of Labor has the average Californian salary yearly to be $40,460, or for a 260-day work year, $155 a day. It seems that the ratepayers bailed out PG&E's bankruptcy to quite an extent, and we're going to have to pay for the new spent fuel. We're going to have to pay for the steam generators and also the turbines, and they come to the first is $56 million, then $110 million, and then $708 million. And it seems to me that the distribution of these costs, if they go through, should not be borne by the ratepayers. And every city, every person is struggling with financial concerns right at this time. And it seems to me it would be prudent for the city to really think about what it's going to cost if all of this goes through. And the last report put out by the county was that PG&E pays 9% of the current property taxes, and the rest of us are picking up the other 91%. And I think that there should be some consideration for the 91%. We cannot buy nuclear insurance. The only insurance that the public can try to obtain is through the people that we elect, providing that you have the will to act to protect us. And I hope that you will do your utmost to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Last call. Okay, seeing none. We'll close community comments and suggestions. That will take us to item number 8, consent agenda. This is a group of items that the council has had an opportunity to review in depth, and we generally approve consent items in one motion. Unless there is a item on the agenda that any member of the council would like to pull for clarification or independent action. What is the will of the council?
I have nothing.
I would like to pull 8L for clarification only. And And before I do that, I will entertain a motion to approve consent items A. No further discussion. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Your Honor, we'd like to excel that for the forum. We'd like to thank you very much for this honor.
Well, thank you very much. And Sal, you take care of yourself, and we'll look forward to seeing you very soon in the future. Thank you all for being here. That's true.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Good night, Sal. Best to you. Steve, I just wanted some clarification on 8L. So could you sort of just summarize where we're going with this? It seems as though we're sort of stepping away from the requirement to have all but one person on the ARC be from a technical background, architectural or design or whatever.
Well, yeah. Thank you. Let me explain that, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Actually, it's more of it more deals with the appointment process. We're not really recommending any changes to the makeup of the ARC. Currently, the ARC is required to be composed of at least a minimum of three individuals with architectural background or some type of architectural technical background. The other two do not require that background. Currently, in terms of the appointment process, to avoid, you know, confusion in terms of who appoints who, it had been specified that the mayor and the mayor pro tem would appoint the two that are not required to have the technical architectural background. Since last year, the council changed the procedure for selecting the mayor pro tem, where that seat now rotates annually. And so the structuring it so the mayor and mayor pro tem make those two appointments no longer works, since we don't make those appointments on an annual basis and the mayor pro tem changes on an annual basis. So what we're recommending is no change in the makeup of the committee, but changing the process so we're not really specifying who appoints who. When vacancies become open, those council members that are going to be making those appointments, we would notify them of what the current makeup is and how many appointments are required to be individuals with architectural background and how many do not. It will require a little bit of coordination if there's kind of a mixture of seats open.
Okay, that answers my question. Any further discussion on 8L? Okay, motion to approve.
So moved.
Seconded.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, that takes us to item 9, public hearing. 9A, consideration of an appeal of the Planning Commission
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the City Council. This is an appeal of a minor use permit for Viewshed Review 04014, which is located at 1470 Sierra Drive. I'm just going to run through a project timeline real quick. The minor use permit for Viewshed Review was originally approved by the Community Development Director on September 7th, at which time it was reported to the Planning Commission. The Commission declined to further discuss the project at a public hearing. It was later appealed to the City Council, to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission did hold a public hearing on October 5th, at which time it unanimously denied the appeal and approved the minor use permit for the Viewshed Review. And it was then appealed to the City Council. Just some background information on the project. As I said, it's located at 1470 Sierra Drive. The appellant's residence is 1480 Sierra Drive, as shown in the aerial photo adjacent to the project property. It does lie within the residential suburban zoning district, and as included in the staff report, staff conducted a visual survey of the neighborhood. Let's pull it up here. Showing that there are several two-story residences in the neighborhood. The green parcels represent property that does have a two-story home. And the gray area is the extent of the survey. There is approximately 38 feet of horizontal separation between the two structures in question at 1470 and 1480 Sierra Drive. The project involves a second-story addition to a single-family residence, which would be located on top of the garage. The project does conform to all applicable standards for the RS zoning district, such as height, setbacks, lot coverage, floor area ratio, and the like. Here's a larger view of the aerial photograph. And if this works, this little highlighted square indicates where the addition would be on the residence at 1470. And the oval represents, I believe, the view that has triggered the appeal process. Here we have a front photograph of the residence at 1470. This is the garage which the addition would be constructed over. Here is from approximately the same spot looking at the residence at 1480. There's about a 15-foot difference in grade between the two properties. This is kind of looking down the middle. There's a large tree and a wall of vegetation that separates the two properties. I went through and compiled the reasons that were stated for the appeal. The first is indicated in a letter of opposition that the appellant submitted when they were originally notified of the viewshed process was a concern that they would lose some winter sunlight. So we used a new modeling program, and this is very crude, admittedly, but it does show shadows on December 21st, which is the winter solstice. The green is the tree and the vegetation. This little square here represents the addition, and and therefore the addition would also be visible. Oops, let's go back. And lastly, on the appeal to the City Council, they stated that the Planning Commission failed to affirmatively make the required findings for viewshed approval. Just run through the findings. There are three findings that have to be met to issue a minor use permit for viewshed review. The first one is that the structure is consistent with the intent of the section, which in this case is 16-16-130. The second is that the proposed structure is consistent with the established scale and character of the neighborhood and will not unreasonably or unnecessarily affect views of surrounding properties. And the third is that the structure will not unreasonably or unnecessarily interfere with the scenic view from any other property. And this is judged in light of permitting reasonable use and development of the property of which the structure is proposed. With that, staff recommends that the City Council adopt the attached resolution, which would deny the appeal, approve the minor use permit for the viewshed review, instruct the Director of Administrative Services to file a notice of exemption, and staff has included findings that do support approval of the project. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Any questions for Brian? Clarifications on the staff report?
Not at this time.
None?
No.
Okay. Brian, I was wondering, could you back up and put those photos that you showed back on?
Do you want the set of four? From the resident?
From the living room, I guess, from the living room.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, this is a public hearing, and any member of the audience at this time that would like to come forward and comment on 9A, we typically allow the applicant to come forward first, and then anyone else who would like to come forward.
You mean the applicant or the appellant?
The appellant.
Yes. I'm Paul Geis, an attorney from Pismo Beach, representing the appellants, Mr. Henry and Sonia Bernard. I noticed from the staff report and the bullets that were placed upon the screen that the staff member indicated that there were only three required findings that had to be made in an affirmative manner in order to approve the applicant's project. And he stated that those required findings were, number one, that the proposed structure is consistent with the intent of this section. The presentation didn't have the bullet as to what the intent of the section is. So we'll go back to that for an overview and character of the neighborhood. And will not unreasonably or unnecessarily affect views of surrounding properties. Excuse me. And number three, that the proposed structure will not unreasonably or unnecessarily interfere with the scenic view from any other property. Now, we had some pictures on the screen that are okay, but they're not as good as the ones I intend to present to the council tonight. I'd like to ask the council, have any of the members viewed or visited the site?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes, I think we all have.
All right, very good. Then this is not completely new to you. The first picture I'd like to introduce is the photograph of the appellant's property located at 1480 Sierra Drive. And it shows.
Is there anyone? Yeah, you can go ahead. You'll get some assistance up there. Okay. Go ahead.
This is the Bernard property, located at 1480 Sierra Drive, and it shows how the property is basically built on a hillside, and it also shows
Mike.
That the
you want to use this one? Here. Sorry about that, Ryan. Didn't mean to zap you in the eye.
That's much better. Much better. Okay. Again, this is the applicant's property, the Bernard property, at 1480 Sierra Drive. And it shows how their property sets down off the frontage road, off the street, quite a ways down. And their living room or front room is in this area back here, down on the lower grade. And of course, the applicant's property is on this side. All right.
Put them up there for you on the
queue. Now, the next picture I'd like to show is the view from the applicant's living room. This is a picture to their front door over that garage area. Now, these two pictures that we've just shown would be the view that we would be disturbed if there was a second addition added to the applicant's home, which is depicted in this picture. Now, the applicant's home is shown here, which is pretty much at street level. It doesn't sit down like my client's property does. It's fairly at street level, very little slope here. Okay, the next picture going up the street shows that that house, too, is built down on the hillside. This is pretty steep slope here, a two-story home that's built on the hillside. And then going up the street further, the next picture, please. This home, too, is down quite a ways off the street level and sitting and pretty steep slope down the backside. And then one more, please. Going up the street further, we have a home that is down off the street level, steep slope, and sits and is built upon this hillside. And then the last one, which is on the other side of my client's property, also is shown being built on the hillside, deep into the lot, below the street level. So if we could put up the applicant's picture once more, that would be the second or third picture. No, the next one. Yeah, after that. That one. So this property, the applicant's home, stands out in relation to the other homes that we've looked at on the street, in that this is off the street level, fairly even with the street level, whereas the others all sit down into the lots and are built on the hillside. Now, that being the case, when the second story is added to this garage level, that will completely obliterate the view of my client's property from their front room. And I submit that if that is the case, that the required findings in section 16.16130 of the development code dealing with minor use permits and view shed review cannot be made, in that the scenic view will be completely obliterated from my client's front room, and the established scale and character.
My name is Bob Montaño, and I'm the owner of 1470 Sierra Drive in Rio Grande. And I just want to start off by, I'll be brief. I have total respect for Henry and Sonia and their views. I'd just like to give you, just reacting to the photographs. I didn't go take pictures of their houses. But the living room, the window that their pictures are taken from, is a back window. In the front of the house, there appears to be, and I've never, given it close scrutiny and gone down to their property to look at it, but it appears to be like four or five floor-to-ceiling windows that look out over the hillside toward the ocean. And I assumed when we were going through our plans that that was their scenic view. And when we went through the planning process with the architect, we were trying to make every consideration for the residents that live above us, thinking that we might affect their view. And we never took into consideration that someone that was on the downgrade would think that their back window was their scenic view. And I apologize for that, but I just want to add that my wife and I are teachers for Lucia Mar. We've been for 29 years. Next year's our 30th year, and it's our retirement year. And this has been a retirement dream for us. The bedroom we currently have in our house is a little over 12 by 12, and we would like to have a more expansive bedroom and have room to move. And The only other thing to add is that both of our parents are very elderly, and we thought that would be great if they would take the opportunity. They have a lot of pride, so I'm not sure that they would. It'd be great to have them move in and have the run of the bottom floor, and that we would occupy the top floor and still be close enough to, you know, take care of their medical needs and to be close to them. So I have nothing more to add, but I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the work that Ryan has done, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who would like to come forward and comment on 9A?
Hello, Ruth Montagna. Good evening. I just have a question because I noticed down here that if I don't bring something up right now, then I can't bring it up later. I wasn't prepared for a lawyer to be here. So all I have to say is that I think attachments 4 and 5 show the pictures, show the situation, and that thank you for coming out to see the property.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one further, we will close public comment on 9A, bring this back to the council. Councilmember Costello, why don't you start this one?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. It's interesting, and when we look at these type of appeals or these type of U-shed reviews, we have to look at three measures. And one is the intent of the section, and I'll read a little bit more than the Mr. Geis read. Stated purpose of section, the first measure is the proposed structure consistent with the intent of the section, and the section is 16.16130. The stated purpose of the section is to preserve the existing scope and character of the established single-family neighborhoods and protect views and aesthetics and other property values in such neighborhoods in a manner that is compatible with reasonable expansion on existing developed lots, outdoor new developments, established scale or conflict with the established neighborhood character, and that's the question we have to decide also. There's no views visible from the public right-of-way that are unreasonably or unnecessarily affected by the construction of this project. And the third is the proposed structure will not unreasonably or unnecessarily interfere with the scenic view from any other property, judged in light of permitting reasonable use and development of the property on which the proposed structure or expansion is about to occur. Again, we come down to definitions, what's reasonable and what's not. And when we look at these types of situations, that's where the decision has to be made. If we look at the development standards for the facility that's proposed, that all of the proposed expansion meets the right setbacks for the front yard, rear yard, side yards. It's well within the lot coverage that's permissible. It's well within the permissible floor area ratio and is permissible within the acceptable building height. Now, I have to admit, looking at the pictures from that back area, and I have to ask, when you're looking at the pictures through the pictures that you submitted earlier, are we looking up? Are we looking at an up angle here? Or are we looking straight out?
If you could, we may have a couple of questions. So, okay.
That's our front room window. And it sits up. So if we sit in the chair, we see that, or if we stand, we see it. I mean, that building is right there.
The perspective here is from a sitting.
Excuse me, just one second. Are we getting feedback on through the for the recording? Okay. Could we ask you to step to the microphone? We may have one or two questions.
Thank you.
It'd be we want to make sure we get this on tape. Sorry about that. If you could just state your name for the record, be good.
My name is Sonia Bernard.
Thank you, Sonia. So the pictures that are up on the projector right now are the ones that I was referring to.
Yeah, they're not as good as
some of the other ones, but these, particularly the ones on the top, are from a sitting perspective. If you're sitting in your sofa or sitting in a chair, you're looking out that window, that's what you're looking at right now. So you're angling up a bit to do that.
The window is a little bit up. Our window, okay, the window is like, I could put my hand on it right here. This is where it's at. So if we're sitting down, you can see it like that. Or if we're standing up, I mean, it's like at my head level. So either way, it's not that we're looking up to that, but we walk out our door, And if it wasn't for those 30-foot vines, that whole garage would be right in our front door. Because okay. It's just where it's... We're on a hillside, like Paul said. And on the other side of them, there's a house on a hillside. But this guy, he sits right... He sits on the road. We sit down below.
And is the picture in the lower right quadrant of that, is that a separate window or is that a close-up on one of the two portions of that window?
That's our front door.
So that's the front door. Henry?
On the right?
That's your front door.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's just this. If you come up to our house, that's our front door. That's our front room.
So that's the view you have right now. Measure, to me, is when we talk about the protecting the views and aesthetics and other property values in such neighborhoods in a manner compatible with reasonable expansion on existing developed lots. And in terms of the other houses and the other structures that are available in this neighborhood, I don't know that that expansion to a second story on that is an unreasonable expansion. Absolutely, it's going to affect your view. There's no question in my mind that there will be an effect on your view. But the question is it reasonable or unreasonable? The second finding is the proposed structure is consistent with established scale and character of the neighborhood. And I did, traveling through the neighborhood, did notice that there were a significant number of other two-story buildings there. So I don't think that it will be inconsistent with the established scale and character of the neighborhood. Will it unreasonably or unnecessarily affect views? Well, in order to put a second story in there, it's going to affect your view. At this point, you have a rather limited view to begin with. So yes, it's going to affect your view, but I don't find it to be an unreasonable affection of that view. And that the proposed structure will not unreasonably or unnecessarily interfere with the scenic view from other property. Judged in light of permitting the reasonable use and development of the property. And I think this is a reasonable use and development on the property. So, Mr. Mayor, I guess my bottom line is that I can support Planning Commission's approval, and I will not support the appeal to overturn it.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Runnels.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I would like to have the attorney go back to the first photo that was put up with the motorhome sitting in the driveway. If you would, please. Considering that at this photo that I'm looking at here in this Exhibit 7, looking out the windows that I presume are going to be to the southwest, I don't see any sign of the motorhome in this photograph that I'm looking at now. As I observed that yesterday when I was out there, the motorhome was parked above that on that driveway, and it would appear to me like it would be blocking some of the view from the of the neighbor's house. Is that not correct? That's a bedroom on that side? Okay. But your main focus of your view is out over the valley. Is that not correct?
I'm sorry to make you get up again, but we need to get this dialogue. So could one of you step back up to the podium? Thanks.
The main focus.
Excuse me. You might want to stay up there.
The main focus of your view is out over looking at the 18. I'm going to support the Planning Commission's decision.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I got a couple quick questions, if you don't mind. If I were to walk up to your house and knock on the front door, where is the front door?
Front door is you go past the motorhome and through a gate, and it's set in. If you look at the overhaul, the view they had on looking down on it, mm-hmm. right there where your
right here.
That's the front door there.
Okay. It's a little deceiving as we look at this particular photo here, but that's okay. So I understand what the, when we're looking at the front door here, it's actually back behind the motorhome.
Is that correct? Oh, yeah. In fact, okay. The motorhome hardly laps the house at all. It's this side of the house.
Correct. Okay. That helps me get a better visual. I think those are all the questions that I have.
Okay.
Thanks. The issue, first of all, the issue from my perspective, anytime we deal with a viewshed review, these are difficult issues. So I want you to know that that we take these seriously, and yet they're difficult because we're dealing with opinions. And reality is this evening that we're going to have to, in my case, I have to make a decision on what's reasonable and what's unreasonable. And I'm going to focus on the, as I look at this particular neighborhood and the character and the scope of this particular neighborhood, which you both have bought into, I'm looking at a what I would call more of a rural setting. You don't have your established sidewalks. It's extremely vegetated. It's you're talking a lot of landscaping. It sits up on a hillside with the primary focus of the viewshed looking out towards Pismo for the most part, and I don't know whether all of these homes have that type of view or not. Whereas the applicant has come forth, I think, with a request to make an expansion onto their particular home, if I were to look at what's reasonable for their request, I have a sneaking suspicion that if they were to possibly look at another location on their property to do a second story, we might be dealing with the other neighbors on the other hand. And so I think they're kind of in a quandary, and I think they're trying to make a reasonable attempt to expand their home for their particular needs. So what I have to do tonight is I have to weigh what's reasonable and what's more reasonable, I guess. And when I look at the scale and character of this particular neighborhood, I see other homes that have expanded, have taken that ability to invest into their homes. I also see that when we talk about the lighting and the sunlight that comes into this particular area, I imagine there are probably certain times because of the slope, because of its articulation with the sunshine and so forth, that there are probably certain seasons that are more sunny than others and so forth. And I think when you bought into these areas, you knew that. Looking up at a second story, but that's something that I think is going to match the character and the scope of this particular neighborhood. So with that, looking at this review, I would move forward with approving staff's recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Runnels asked the question that I was going to ask with regard to potential additional views that might be present within the living room area or the lower floor area. And I guess for me, related to that, I would come back to finding three, where it says the proposed structure will not unreasonably or unnecessarily interfere with the scenic view. I'm looking at the pictures that we've seen this evening, and I understand that there may well be some scenic value to being able to see a piece of the sky. But with regard to at least the way I process viewshed, scenic view to me means looking out towards the open area and perhaps to the south, southeast, and where you can really get expansive dimension to the view. That's where the value is. The viewshed for that part of the living room, if that were impaired, I think there would be different circumstances here. As has been mentioned, this is a delicate issue in terms of balancing you know, the rights of a view versus the property rights to expand. And I can feel for both sides because, I personally was involved in this when we built our first home here in Arroyo Grande. We had to contend with viewshed concerns from neighbors. And it's not a pleasant thing. But the bottom line is the resolution, I think, is a give and take. There has to be sort of tolerance and flexibility on both ends. The bottom line here is that, as the mediator so artfully explained in my situation, you know, you folks have to live next to each other. And so hopefully as this moves forward, there will be some consideration. I think with the additional height on the adjacent structure, it probably would be beneficial if in the design of that upper floor you could put some dimension or articulation so they're not staring out at a blank concrete wall. I'm not sure how you do that, but perhaps there can be some pleasing architectural feature that gets away from just a massive blank stucco wall. That's not pleasing for anyone. And yes, we recognize that it's probably going to take away a bit of the sky. But again, I think there, the value of the scenic view is in a different direction. So I would concur with my colleagues and support the Planning Commission's decision. And with that, I will entertain a motion. Okay, this takes us to 10A, consideration of water supply recommendations. Good evening, Don.
Good evening. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. This evening, we're returning to the council with recommendations based on the previous discussions we had regarding the water supply. We have four recommendations that we'll be presenting to the council this evening. One is to coordinate an update of the water and sewer rate study that was performed in 2003, which would implement a tiered rate structure. We're also recommending that the direct staff to solicit a proposal for a new groundwater study. We'd also like to proceed with further development of the Nacimiento water supply option, and also the last recommendation here is to prepare an initial study on the cost and feasibility of constructing a desalinization plant. And we're going to talk about and go through each one of these recommendations for...
You want to wait till we get done for questions, Don, or you want to...
Yeah, if you could, we're going to go through each one of these, and I, at that time, if you have questions, please.
Yeah, maybe you can finish an alternative, and if we have any questions on that alternative, we'll take a pause and get them clarified.
The strategy that we've developed is a two-phase strategy. The first phase of that would be alternatives to meet the demand for the next 10-year period. So we'd be looking, the recommendations are formulated based on one demands over the next 10-year period, and the second part of that would be alternatives that identified will provide permanent water supply increases to meet the long-term demand. Phase one, these are the items that we've identified. There are five items here that we've identified: the water conservation and public education outreach, which we've started. We're going to begin that coming in January. We have some that we've have drafts on already. A well 10, Price Canyon oil field water, the tiered rate structure, and also the utility retrofit program. The water conservation public outreach or education, we're looking at increasing the implementation of water conservation through the public education efforts that we have available to us. One is the city newsletter. We have also the newspapers, the Time Press Recorder. We have brochures that I mentioned earlier that we were preparing to put into the bills for the water bills, and also a cable television access channel. We also have the city's website that we would be posting things on. And if you have questions on any of these, please stop me. Well 10, and this was an item that was brought to the council in September, where we started the ball rolling to with a professional services agreement for the design of the well. Phase one of that project will be completed in next summer, 05, with the construction of the actual well itself. Phase two will take us to spring of 05. That is the pump. That quantity can be diverted from downstream releases to actual use by the urban users. There's a potential. The schedule here is winter of 06. And as I mentioned, we're working with the county, but the county is actually doing an environmental study. They're looking at doing some of the permitting with the regulatory agencies, and as well as some of the right-of-way issues to bring the pipeline from the oil field to the dam.
I do have a question on that, Don.
Okay.
Now, we're talking about the base of the dam, so it's when this water is brought into the system, it'll be above the treatment facility.
That's correct.
So it will run through the treatment facility. Is that correct?
Well, I think the idea at this point is to take that water and put it into the headworks or the upstream part of the creek, where the release is from the dam.
So it'll recharge the creek, and then that will allow us to diminish the water that we take out of the lake.
That's correct.
Okay. And there's a correlation, which I'm sure you're going to get to when we talk about Nacimiento, but there's a correlation between Price Canyon and Nacimiento.
Yes, there is.
That you'll
yes.
explain later. Okay.
I will.
Thanks.
One other point also, Don, and I don't know, has it been determined yet whether the fingerprint of the water that's going to come from the oil field is going to be detrimental to the aquatic life at this point in time?
I don't think so. You know, I think that's going to be part of the initial environmental study. I'm sure that's going to be a major factor in the study itself. But it hasn't been determined yet.
Refresh me a little bit. I think it's been determined that the water will go into a pond and then it'll percolate out into the creek bed itself after it's been retained in the pond for a little while.
That's I think the option that we're looking at to remineralize it and maybe get that fingerprint established before it actually flows down the creek.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back one slide to on well number 10? You passed it already.
Am I going too fast?
Keep going. You went past it almost immediately. It was the first one you went back to.
Going the wrong way.
You're going the wrong way now. Oops. I think one more should do it. Yeah, there we go. Estimated cost on this well is $490,000, in effect. That's the cost to get this well up and producing. Is that what we're looking at?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And then what would be the cost to keep that well functioning on a yearly basis?
I don't have...
Significant, insignificant? Because I'm looking at this. If you take $490,000 and divide it by 160 acre feet, that's about $3,200 an acre foot. Obviously, if we can spread that cost over a number of years, then that cost comes down. So mm-hmm. I guess the question I'm getting at is what would the cost per acre foot be on? Overall, the cost per acre foot on this is relatively low.
Compared to the other sources, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
when you one of the reasons for the cost being that high is you're going to have to install a separate treatment facility there at that facility, correct?
Yes. At the well, we will install a small treatment facility, similar to Well 9.
And that cost is not included in what we're looking at right there?
I believe the cost is included in there.
Is included?
Yes.
What's the depth anticipated for that well, then?
I don't know. I think it's several hundred feet.
One quick question on well number 10, Don. The aquifer that we pull out of well 10, is it the same as well 9? And that's first question. Second is, have there been any preliminary impact studies if we increase the draw from well number 10? What is the impact going to be on other wells in the area, and is it connected across Oak Park at all?
To answer the first question, the answer is yes. It is in the same aquifer as Well 9. So they're although they're separated by some distance, they probably will not have an effect on each other. The effect that Well 10 will have in that particular area. There has been an investigation previously done by a local geologist that indicated that there were some private wells in the area, but none that are very close proximity to Well 10. And I think that's where the site was chosen to begin with, because of its proximity or because it's farther away from any of the other existing wells.
Have those studies at all considered the project in Pismo right now, Los Robles?
Yes. I think when there was an initial study done on that site, that did consider the two wells that are on the other side of Oak Park in the county adjacent to the city of Pismo Beach.
Well, they had just completed some analysis on that project related to water, where it was determined that those wells, particularly with our wells, would not have sufficient water, and that's how the city of Pismo Beach has now worked with the developer on an alternative that involves not using those wells at Los Robles to their full capacity and instead putting back into service two other wells in another area of Pismo Beach to serve that project.
I guess my concern here is how is all this going to be orchestrated when we start increasing the production on well number 10 after the construction? How is this all going to be orchestrated with a neighboring jurisdiction?
We've discussed with the city of Pismo Beach, and they conceptually have agreed there. We both agree that there is probably a need to enter into a gentleman's agreement, as we have with the other water basin, but we haven't moved ahead with anything yet.
I would think that are jurisdictional issues as a prelude to moving forward with phase one.
And we have had some preliminary discussions with them, and but we can certainly meet with them and develop some sort of agreements or understandings, if you will, as to the operations of this particular well.
Well, we have, we're in the process of changing councils, and I'm not sure if that affects staff at all. But we need to probably keep this on the front burner and make sure that we're in sync on this, because I am concerned about the manner in which we orchestrate the usage. That housing project is going to be a tremendous draw, and I'm a little bit shaky about what you described, Steve, of ensuring that they don't draw from the original wells, but they're moving to alternatives where we don't know, and so I guess I would like to like a higher comfort level here that we've covered all the bases.
One follow-up, Mr. Mayor, please.
Sure.
Don, has there been any geological work done by one of these water experts on the estimated quantity in that Pismo formation?
That's where we got the numbers from. And so that work that was done.
And how big a basin is that?
It's fairly good size. Of course, not as big as the one that we're in with our other wells, but it's fairly good size. And according to them, there's water available down there, so it just needs to be treated a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
We talked about Price Canyon. The next item is the tiered water and sewerage structure. Now, that's included in our Phase 1 analysis or options. Now, the tiered water and sewerage structure is to provide some sort of financial incentives for conservation. We presently are developing the educational materials for conservation, but also this provides a financial incentive through the tiered rate structure, and that provides for unit prices that change with the usage of volumes of water. This inverted rate structure or tiered rate structure promotes water conservation. Other jurisdictions are presently using it. It does indicate that it does work. There is a potential savings of between 7% and 20%. As I mentioned, the other cities in the county are doing it, the only exception being Grover Beach and AG at the moment. And this structure is anticipated to provide some rate relief for those on fixed incomes.
Any questions on the tiered water rate structure?
Don, I'm assuming you're going to bring back, it talks about some type of tiered water structure. Part of the proposal is to look at what the options are. It's not just, there are different types of tiered.
Yeah, really, the objective this evening is hopefully just to get direction that when we go back to do this next rate study, that the direction would be to go ahead and incorporate a tiered rate into that, but then there would be some options that we'd come back with as a result of that study.
And I would think that this is going to be similar to what happened at the Lopez retrofit project. You know, we talked about that and went through meetings and hearings about it for several years, and no one really paid any attention until they found out that they were going to have to pay for it and it was going to cost them, and they got hit in the pocketbook, and then all of a sudden we had a lot of people at our meetings. What happened? So I just think that the public should know that regardless of what happens, we're all going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, and there's some good statistics and some good information as to where the tiers, who fits in the what tier, and I think we'll present that all to you when we do that study, bring that back to you for your consideration.
I do have a comment on that, Don. I'm not a big fan of this, as I've stated on prior occasions. I want to make sure that the stage that you talked about earlier, or the phase that you talked about, water conservation and public education. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to that for just a second as it relates to the tiered water structure, because we talked about ensuring that the conservation and public education component precedes the decision to impose a tiered water rate structure. In other words, we're giving them the opportunity to voluntarily conserve before we move to something that resembles a punitive measure here. The recommendation when we had this discussion before, I believe, was made by Commissioner Keene and talked about the manner in which water bills are crafted and the terminology, and we were looking for more clarification about specific consumption rates for each home in gallons, not units, so that people could understand in lay terms just, you know, specifically what amount of water they were using so that they had an idea of where they could cut back or how much they needed to cut back. And there was some discussion, I think, at the time that indicated that our current computer program would not, a billing program would not allow us to do that, but there could be some kind of a supplement or a crosswalk, if you will, that would make the conversion from units into gallons. Can you bring us up to speed on what's happening with that?
Yeah, we have implemented that. It's a line that, basically gives the information so somebody can transfer units into gallons. We've also started a number of other public information efforts. We've had, in my article that I do in the TPR, we focused on water conservation. We've had an article in the Stagecoach Express, so that has begun. We're starting to put together the brochures now to go out in the utility bills. We thought it would be best to kind of wait after the rainy season for those because I think they'd be more effective in the period when we need more conservation rather than the middle of the rainy season. But so we're well underway on the public education effort.
Okay, thanks.
And yes, it's important, but you know, up front, we need to know that these are other measures that we'll be looking at that may impact the bottom line of our household and commercial users, and that they need to be part of the process and give us input as to what they feel might best serve our needs.
Steve, also along with your public information, it may be good to point out that when it is raining, it might be wise if people went out and changed the clock on their lawn so they weren't sprinkling the lawn at the same time as raining, because you go driving around town and you'll see some of these commercial areas, the hospital, and in some of our parks where it's raining and the sprinklers are running, which is ridiculous.
We've, rather than reinvent the wheel, we've obtained a number of brochures from other agencies, particularly the water agencies, and actually some of them are fairly specialized. We'll probably be putting out particular materials just on landscaping and watering and others on household items, so we'll probably have a variety of brochures that go out, and some targeting those exact type of things.
Now, the council at the last meeting also requested that a retrofit upon sale program be investigated. Now, this program sets forth the possibility of requiring property owners to retrofit their home before it is sold. In this program, the seller or their agent must retrofit the plumbing fixtures to meet the criteria of low water use. And the program can, and it is recommended by staff, that it be set as a self-certification. Therefore, there are, no inspection costs, where the onus is on the seller or the agent selling to come forth to the city, certify that this piece of property is retrofitted and is using low-flow water fixtures, and then obtain a certificate from the city to proceed with escrow. So that's strictly a... puts the onus on the seller to do that. The second phase of the options that we would like to talk about include a longer range type of standard supplier of water that for groundwater. The Nacimiento project is also a source that we're looking at, reclaimed water, desalinization, and state water. The first item there is the groundwater. This would be in conjunction with the other agencies in the Basin Management Agreement. However, there really hasn't been any commitment received by any of the other agencies at this point, although there have been some dialogue. There has not been any commitment at this point. We have a cost here. This is just an estimate, and this, of course, will be shared with the city's estimate of about $50,000, but proposals are based only on preliminary discussions. So we really haven't had any discussions as to exactly what we want to study, except that we would like it to include an analysis of the safe yield of the basin. There are other things that it could include. It could include contour, Department of Water Resources. We'd like to take this information and update it. This was... of the Aurora Grande and the Pomo Mesa area. So this is the study that we'd be updating.
Do we anticipate that going into that study that we're likely to see that there's more water there than we thought there was, or that we can just take more water than we've been taking in the past? What's the outcome we're looking for?
Well, I think the positive outcome would be that there would be additional water available for us to use on an annual basis to pump from the basin. That would be the favorable outcome. The other outcome might be that there isn't any water, or there is less water that we thought might be there. But I think we also want to know that so that we can manage the basin and manage the amount of water that we extract from the basin to do a couple of things. One, to maintain this as a sustainable water source, and also to prevent seawater intrusion and possibly eliminating this as a water source. So I think we want to know all of what's going on underground in this water basin.
And what's the source for the information that we have that we're operating on now for the groundwater? What model are we using? What's the data behind it?
The source we're using now is existing wells. And this is the information that was provided in the study that was done by DWR in 2002. There were wells throughout the basin. There's a list of wells out there that we monitor, or there's monitoring of the well, of the depth of water in each of the wells. So that's the primary basis.
Is there really an overreaching or overarching study of all of this groundwater that we're looking at, or are we just going from individual data from individual wells?
Well, I think the study that we're looking to do specifically focuses on the sub-basin that we're in. Now, it will look at water that comes in and out of our basin, but specifically looking at our little basin and how what is the safe yield, what can the safe yield be of that basin?
One of the things I think we want to emphasize, too, and the reason why our cost estimate for this study expanded significantly and we're proposing that we expand the scope is more than just trying to look at finding what the safe yield amount is at any given time. Learned that there's a number of things these studies can include that will enable us over time on an ongoing basis to better manage the groundwater table. And I think that's really our goal now, is to gain information from a study that we can use on an ongoing basis, setting up a more effective management program of the basin with the other agencies in the area. Don gave one example. They can actually prepare a model of saltwater intrusion that you can monitor over time, and that gives you a lot of information to help you more appropriately monitor the basin. That's really the goal at this point of what we're recommending.
There are a couple of things worth noting with regard to this this particular issue. Although it's a Phase 2 issue, it has major Phase 1 implications because under the groundwater management agreement that we have, if there's additional safe yield in the basin, and again, based on what we know now, it's likely that there is, or at least there's not a deficit. Potentially a good factor that came out in talking with the city's legal counsel in the litigation, he had talked about this issue at a meeting, joint meeting with all the local agencies, and he solicited a very draft initial proposal from Dr. Priestaff, who's one of the experts that we're using in the litigation, and the cost that she estimated at this point in time is about $100,000, not $200,000, so it could be substantially less. Those are all, you know, issues that need to be considered when you're looking at this particular alternative.
Don, on the DWR report that was done, I think it was a 69 report. Wasn't that one of the first ones that we had?
79. Yes.
And then we got the 2000 report. What's the difference in safe yield? Is it basically the same? Has it gone up or gone down, or where do we stand?
Well, I think the safe yield remained the same. What they came up with is the water budget, which is a calculation of what goes in and what comes out. And they said that over time in the future, 2010 or 2015 or whatever it was, that there will be the water budget will be equal, or if not, just slightly less, so that water may be a little bit less in the future. So that was the outcome of the 2002 study.
And that's all predicated on rainfall and the whole bunch of
rainfall,
the coin type situation.
The flow in the creek,
But one of the things about it, too, is I understand that with this study, it may give us an opportunity to be able to manage the basin a little better so you can pump a little more water in the wetter years so that you have a place to put it when the dam is full. Is that not part of the deal?
That's certainly part of it. Absolutely.
Don, I'm not sure where the focus of the DWR study was when the statement was made. Wasn't there language, could have been, as it relates to that part of the sub-basin towards Nipomo, was there not language in there that indicated that we were verging towards overdraft? I remember a fairly strong statement in that study to that effect.
Yeah, and, you know, the study changed. It started out in, I believe it was 97, is when this original report started out. And it evolved, and things changed. So there were statements in there in various drafts that changed. But there was a statement at one time that there was a pumping depression or some sort of overdrafts condition up on the Nipomo Mesa, yes.
And there are still some thought processes in that direction, based on what we see coming out in the newspaper about the accelerated development in the Mesa based on, you know, the best available data that they have in the form of a study. Mm-hmm. I guess my concern as we move forward with this, and it's been stated by previous councils, and I agree, I'm hoping that as we move forward with this study that the technology and the science is at a better level than it has been in the past. Variables, too many different outcomes based on supposedly the same data. So I don't know where that leaves us, but I'm very skeptical about investing a great deal of money. We may have to do it, but go through the motions. But I don't have a lot of confidence in what I've seen develop so far. We have a bunch of water consultants that get rich. And as a result of that, you know, we get sometimes conflicting data that come out of those studies. So, I don't know. I'll get off my soapbox, but I'm just hoping that that whatever study we fund produces some better data than we've had in the past.
When we come forward with an RFP, we'll detail the scope of work much greater in terms of the exact information will be coming out of it. But once again, that was kind of the position we were in when we first recommended this at the last report. We had identified a very low cost, and it was basically costed out kind of the minimum to get what we felt we needed. But when we researched it more, we were told that if you really want to get data and a study and a model and things that are going to be valuable and more accurate, that involves the greater investment, so that's why we went in that direction.
Mr. Mayor, just a couple points of clarification. Don, when we talk about the groundwater study, we are talking about just studying the sub-basin that we are currently dealing with, not the entire Santa Maria Basin. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so we're talking about the management of our or the portion of our sub-basin. Mm-hmm. Second of all, how does the agricultural wells that are part of this management, current management system, play into this groundwater study, and what type of cooperation, if any, are we looking at the private well owners to contribute information based on good management practices?
Well, it's been my understanding that the county has a good relationship with the farmers, that they are allowed to go on their property to measure the depths of the water in the wells. They have privacy agreements that they not, use this information in any other way but to provide information and data for analysis of the groundwater. So I believe we have a fairly good database of wells, private and public, that contribute to the information in these studies.
Okay. The wells are measured twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall, by the county.
You know, and that's the real hard data that we have to work with. As the mayor mentioned, the other things that become a little bit less tangible are the how much goes in, you know, how much infiltrates from our ponding basins, how much infiltrates from the creek, and those sorts of things. And so it's a little bit it does get to be based on experience and those sorts of things. The next project is the Nacimiento project that we mentioned earlier. The pipeline, at this point, before we go into that full-blown EIR process, this will help determine the cost feasibility in comparison to other options prior to doing this supplemental EIR. We'd like to look at various options, various costs, some of the other issues that we can get our hands on at the moment instead of jumping directly into the supplemental EIR. We've talked to the county. We have some time to do that. And I think this evening the recommendation would be to do that and then use that information to determine whether we go forward with the supplemental EIR or not.
Any questions?
Don, a supplemental EIR would be required, though, if we were to move forward in the future on a proposed pipeline extension.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, we would need to do a supplemental EIR for the alignment that we propose from San Luis, yes.
And the conjunction between the the Price Canyon Oil Field Water Project, obviously that's going to be part of that would be developing a pipeline from the Pismo or Edna Valley area over to the base of the dam. Mm-hmm. We would then be having to figure out, obviously, connection from San Luis Obispo to that particular area and then from the base of the dam down to our treatment because we wouldn't be using the same water. Obviously, if we were to get water from Nacimiento, we wouldn't be using that same water in the same way we would be using the Price Canyon oil field water. Is that correct?
That's correct. We would want to use the Nacimiento water. We would probably want to use that and put it through the treatment plant as opposed to putting it down the creek.
Okay.
However, if that line were in place and the plains water did disappear, well, you would still have the lower end of that line that could be used for Nacimiento water, right?
That's correct, yeah, and I think that would be analyzed in the EIR. Would keep that pipeline and size it with that in mind if Nacimiento was the viable option.
I think the intent of this study would be to determine the cost for the project if we had to do the entire line, and then also the cost if we could utilize the line from the Price Canyon oil field as a portion of the line and connect to it. So that we'd get two cost estimates out of the study would be the purpose.
So we're talking about potentially both sources of water going through the same pipe. And the only difference is through that reach, there would be a diversion to the base of the dam and a diversion to the treatment plant.
Right. In the first 10 years, we'd use the water from the oil field and put that in the base of the dam. And then we'd divert that after that. When Nacimiento got connected, we'd divert it down to the treatment plant.
Okay.
So there would be no...
It's important to keep in mind that the oil field water is probably only a 10-year supply. So that would be used for that period, and then we would use it for Nacimiento after that.
All right, so there's no way that we could technically have...
We had a meeting with the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District staff regarding the wastewater treatment plant. The studies that they have done previously, and there's been several, indicate that the option of using reclaimed water is somewhat cost prohibitive at this moment, since there are limited sites that could easily utilize the water. There's a problem with getting it from the treatment plant to the ultimate the user or the source where it would be needed, and the cost for that infrastructure results in a significant cost and disruption, could result in a disruption to the city's street system, which we've been diligently paving or trying to pave over the past several years.
How much water are we talking about potentially in reclaimed water?
I am assuming that the plant takes in a couple of million gallons a day to treat, 2 to 3 million gallons a day it takes in as treatment. That's 9 acre feet a day. They would treat most of that, I would assume. So there's a potential, I guess, for anywhere from 5 to 9 acre feet of water available per day.
Space that over the whole year, talking 1,500 acre-feet of water?
Potentially, I would think, yeah. Depending on the size of the plant and the need. But I think that's an available amount of water that they have. Mm-hmm. How much they would treat or, you know, would be something that might be a little less, if, depending on the users.
And there's no economical users for that water?
I think the study that they've done so far indicate that the cost is more than other sources at this particular time. There are users, there are sites that they could bring it to. The Caltrans site of the landscaping along the 101. There's the cemetery. There's the schools. There's the Wildwood. There's users irrigation water. But it's the infrastructure to get it from there to here is what is the major cost that prohibits it from being as effective as we would think it would be, would want it to be.
And then it's on the downhill side. You've got to push it all uphill besides.
And the users are fairly well scattered in different locations, and there aren't any real major, major users. I mean, it's not like having a golf course close by or something like that that can use a tremendous amount of water at one site.
Along with the reclaim water discussions that we had with the district, we also talked about desalinization and the possibility of locating a plant at the existing wastewater treatment plant. This provides some advantages. One of them is the ability to cost, what the operating costs would be, those sorts of things.
What are the disadvantages?
The disadvantages, I think, one of the disadvantages, it might take a while to get it online. And that's why we've included it in the Phase 2 strategy, because of the regulatory agencies that we'd have to go through to get permitting for that for a facility of this size or this type. That's one of the disadvantages. I think that would be one of the biggest disadvantages. Of course, we have brine to deal with, which is the byproduct of the desalinization product. We think we have an advantage of locating it at the wastewater treatment plant, and we can utilize the existing outfall line. But the disadvantage is, what do you do with that brine? We've kind of turned that into an advantage of siting it at the existing wastewater plant. The energy costs, of course, that goes into the production costs of the water itself, but that is certainly something that uses quite a bit of energy to force the water through the membranes to clean up the water. That's another disadvantage of that. Although, again, citing it at the sand district plant, there's a potential to use methane as a generator of electricity that could be used for some of the needs of the desal plant.
And generally, the cost, once again, is an issue. One of the advantages of what we proposed here is if we can do a preliminary cost study on the Nacimiento option and the desal option, then we can compare those to see what we believe is going to be the more cost-effective option.
Well, what has been the track record for desal plants up and down the coast. I know Morro Bay has got theirs over there, and it seemed to me, I'm not certain, but it seemed to me that there was some issue with introducing the brine back through the outfall into the ocean, high levels, high concentrations of brine in terms of the ocean ecology and the, the habitat, so on and so forth. So,
And that's why
the Coastal Commission that I'm sure would.
That's one of the regulatory agencies that it might take a while to get through, and I think that's why citing it at the Sand District provides some advantages in that respect. What they have one in Morro Bay, they had one in Santa Barbara, they have one that they're constructing, I think, in San Diego. But the technology is changing so much that it's really difficult to compare what they did 5 years ago with what we want to do now because the technology is so different. They've had some issues with the mechanical parts of it in Morro Bay. They've had some other problems with the membranes and, as you say, the brine as well. But it's very difficult to compare them because of the technology has changed. So what they did, we would not do.
Well, I would think that that would be the first area that we would perhaps do a cost-benefit analysis would be maintenance and upkeep of the plant and the manner in which the successor lack thereof of the plants that are currently online and then take a look at how, as you put it, Don, the technology has changed that might affect those.
And I think that's what we're trying to do with this small analysis, is to try to do that, to look at it a little more closely and compare it with Nacimiento so we can kind of get a little bit more feel of what it's going to take. What are we actually up against there in that case? State water was also one of the long-term. There's been discussions recently with the county and the CCWA, the Central Coast Water Authority, on purchasing state water for our county. Additional water may be available through an increase in the state water pipeline. There's been some analysis that may indicate that there may be some more water that they can push through the pipeline that may be available for purchase for our county. So that's certainly an option. It's evolving over time, and we're certainly going to keep an eye on that.
How long before they're going to have some data on that?
I think they've indicated, at least from what I've heard, that there is some water available. How we get it is what they're trying to work out. Do we trade? Do we, how do we actually contractually gain an entitlement to that water?
Have they come up with any cost factor yet?
I don't think so. I haven't heard anything. I just heard that there may be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 acre feet that may be available for our county, but I have not heard of any costs yet.
Because if that, in my opinion anyway, if that was the case, well, that would probably be the cheapest and quickest water that we could get with a pretty darn good reliability, considering the county has a large portion of drought resistance built into it with the amount of water that they bought over the thing. So I think that's one that should be added to the study list, too.
Your questions kind of outline the problems we've had, though. There's been so many unknowns that that's why we decided we wanted to move forward aggressively with some other options, but continuing to monitor that to see if it's going to come forward as an option. But it's been difficult getting anything as far as any kind of commitment or solid information that it is going to be a feasible option.
That concludes the information that we have this evening. I'd like to just go back to the recommendations. We have four recommendations. One of them is to coordinate an update of the sewer and water rate study, to solicit some proposals to do the groundwater, some information regarding that to present to the council as to what would go into that groundwater study and the potential cost to the city. And then developing some costs, some further development on the Nacimiento project and the desalinization plant. We need to look at those a little closer so that we can have some more information to base a decision on either which way to go, either Nacimiento or the desal plant. Oh, and we'd also like to get council's direction on the utility retrofit upon sale program. That was something that was asked for. We do have some information on that and bring that updates back to you at from time to time.
Okay. Well, you know, we're looking at a comprehensive list of recommendations, and I would like to include the fact that we are going to work aggressively with the county on this Plains exploration, the Price Canyon source, and not just wait for them to come to us with it. I would like it to be part of the comprehensive plan. At least that's my position on it.
Okay. And can we include the state water situation in that also so that that doesn't get lost in the shuffle?
I think we can. I'm sure we can.
Or is it another recommendation?
Okay. Are there any other questions on the staff report? Okay. Seeing none at this time, this is not a public hearing, but there are members of the audience. Anyone would like to come forward and make a comment on 10A, this would be an opportunity for you.
Mayor, Council, Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I really share the mayor's frustrations over the groundwater studies. It's very frustrating to get, it's like adding up a column of numbers and getting a different answer every time. I don't know how many times we can do that before we just get frustrated with the problem. My concern more is regarding the tiered rate situation. I think that we need, as a city, to do as much as we can to find ways not to do a tiered rate. If we can get semi-voluntary action through something to do with real estate and when properties are turned over. One of my thoughts was that we right now we have a facade grant program where we are giving grants or participating in facade redevelopment up and down, especially Grand Avenue. I was wondering if there couldn't be some kind of a program set up for, as a rebate or grant-type program for people who would take traditional lawn and different kinds of water, high water usage, and if they were to take those and remove them and put in a xeriscape or do plantings with local plants that do not require as much water as the traditional landscape might, that might facilitate the changeover. Mr. Runnels has often mentioned that he feels that landscape, and I agree with him, is probably uses a lot more water than flushing a toilet. I think if we could develop some kind of a program where people would actively, the city would actively participate in changing out those landscapes, that might be a good thing to do. Have a great resource in Cal Poly, a very good agricultural school. We might be able to come up as a city and talk with Cal Poly and see if some of their...
Thank you. While we're at Cal Poly, we might look at their engineering department, see if they might want to do a class project on our groundwater study. They've got a fairly well-developed civil engineering department there. Or anything else that they might be able to help out with on this whole effort. Anyone else would like to come forward? Okay. Close public comment on 10A. Bring it back. Councilmember Dickens,
thank you, Mr.
start
Mayor.
Us off here.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'd like to just compliment the staff report, Don, and I think that you've done a thorough job. I've been kind of hesitant as we go through this process because I know there's just so much detail that's going to need to take place for looking at
you know, good sources for future water reliability and so forth. And I know there's going to be a lot of questions down the road, but I think we're moving in the right direction. I think you've put together a comprehensive strategy to address both the short-term and long-term needs. And I think that as I look through the recommendations that you have before us this evening, I think we have some real good possibilities. And I think that we need to do the studies to give us better information so we can make better decisions down the road as to how we're going to address these needs. I'll just go through each one of these in some of my comments, but definitely the water conservation public education is something we need to concentrate on, put some effort into. I'd like to maybe even add as part of our billing system to maybe even place certain goals for individual users to say, you know, this is what we would as a city would like to project, maybe something to shoot for. That might be something that we could at least look at, and that needs to be certainly our first plan of attack, and see if we can get folks to kind of look at their water usage and put it in perspective. Our biggest problem is we actually do have some fairly cheap water, and so it makes it easy just to go out there and do our landscaping and so forth. So it's not a big hit in regards to some of the other bills that we pay. But nonetheless, I think we need to be cognizant of that that finite resource. I like the idea that Mr. Ross just brought up in regards to some incentives focusing primarily on landscaping. I think that would be something we really should take a look at. If we could provide some financial incentives for property owners to transition from a traditional landscaping, which is high water use, to a lower water use, and if we had some criteria in order to establish what that actually meant, and we could help with that initial transition, the benefit to that consumer over time would certainly be reduced bill, and certainly help in the long run. And I think that needs to be an option, of course voluntarily, but it needs to be a real good option for folks, and I'd like to look at that. In regards to well number 10 and its location and tiered water and sewer rate structure, again, I'm not so sure. I think that it sounds good in practice, but I think that there are some inequities when we start looking at it. When we looked at this in the past, I think that there are some questions that come up in regards to penalizing folks from an equity issue. And so I'm just cautious about the tiered water structure, but I think we still need to look at it. I want to see what the options are, and I want to look at what that might mean to our users ultimately and so forth, because I think that we can, in all good faith, we need to move forward with our conservation public education standpoint, but until it actually hits you in the pocketbook, sometimes that's when we might see the bigger changes. But I think we just need to have that information. The groundwater study, I've read the 1979 DWR report. I've cruised through at least the draft report for the 2002 DWR, and it's sometimes more of an art than it is a science. And so I think we need to get some good numbers. But I think it's something that will be valuable. As Tim suggested earlier, I think there's some other both direct and indirect benefits from doing this particular study that we need to have that information for our sub-basin. So I'm certainly supportive of moving forward with the groundwater study. I think we need to know whether or not the Nacimiento project is something that's going to benefit us or not in comparison to our other options. And so I think we need to move forward, as you suggested, in doing the preliminary engineering report prior to moving into a supplemental EIR that'll, in my opinion, will probably be fairly costly. And before we take that jump forward, it'll be important to know who the you know, what the parameters will be and who the participants here in the South County might be. As I reflect back to probably about 6 years ago when we had our presentations on reclaimed water from John Wallace, you know, the technology's there, the funding's there, but it's the end user and how we get that water, and then the stigma around the reclaimed water that is really the issue, which is why I'm really pleased that we're concentrating more on the desal plant, and I think that's something we need to focus on. I think it has some greater benefits, certainly some concerns, but I think those issues can be resolved. We do, because of the plant siting, I think there's some benefits, and we already have a type of use there that I think the Coastal Commission and all the regulatory agencies will kind of look at, and the infrastructure's in place. We would not be able to probably do a desal plant in any other location here in the South County. So the property's there, and I believe we've actually done some initial studies through the Sand District on desalinization, I think. Is that... I'm not sure. I know we did the reclaimed water, but I'm not sure how much we've gone into desal, be involved in that process to see what the possibilities are. And last but not least, when we talk about the utility retrofit upon a sale of a home, I think that it's important, as I sit at the Sand District and understand our sewer and how it's directly related to our conservation efforts, what I'm finding is that there may be some indirect impacts in doing a lot of retrofitting. And what we're finding down at the plant is that the strength of our wastewater is actually increasing. And because of our biological and chemical processes that we use to treat the sewer water now, we have the capacity is systematically growing as our area grows for the plant's capacity. But what we're finding is because of the conservation efforts, which are all good, it's increasing the sewer. What's coming into the plant, which means that it places a higher impact on the plant to process that waste, and it's creating some redundancy issues, and maybe some actually significant additional capital improvements may need to be put into that plant prior to its original build out because of our conservation efforts, which is actually really an indirect consequence of our good intentions of doing conservation. So I'm a little concerned with that, and I'm not really sure that we're really going to get the best bang for our buck with the retrofits. I think we're going to get a bigger bang if we looked at the landscaping. So those are my comments, but all in all, compliments to staff in regards to the all of the different opportunities that we have, and I think that we need to move forward as directed. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Reynolds.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and I'm not going to be as long as Mr. Dickens was. You know, we need to keep all these things on the table. I mean, A, B, C, and D are all fine, and I think you need to agree with the mayor that you need to add the Plains project to it and the retrofit project and also the state water, because these, you know, you never know when the game is going to shift a little bit. And so we need to keep all those options available. And I would lean toward the Nacimiento water and the state water for the simple reason that we can put all that in at the headworks and we don't have to pump it. We've already got the infrastructure in play if the numbers work out correctly. And I think that we should really put some emphasis on trying to get state water if it's available. The desalinization, you know, that's going to be drought-proof. There's no question about that, but it's also going to be very, very expensive. All of these things that we've talked about, adding the well is going to be necessary. Maybe we won't need to use that water in the system per se, but it may be able to transfer it over and use it on the park so that we can save the good water and we won't have to treat it so much. Yeah, probably one of the things that's going to help a lot is this retrofit on the sale of property, because knowing what we know about a lot of people, they say, yeah, we're going to do it, or we'll do it next week, and it won't get done, and then the inspection process will go away, and then it'll start to rain, and we'll have plenty of water, and nobody will understand what's going on. Versus the guy that was only using a little bit, so I'm looking at about 180,000 gallons of water versus 25,000 gallons of water in that length of time. Is that so? You know, maybe the people that are using a lot of extra water need to pay a little bit more. I don't have any problem with the tiered rates we got on the gas bills, we got on electric bills, and that's just a fact of life. And so, if we're going to use the resources, we need to pay for it. But I think you've done a great job on the staff report, and I'll be watching from the sidelines to make sure you're going forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, I have to echo some of the comments I've heard both of my colleagues say. First, I think we do need to keep as many of these things on the table, if not all of them, as possible. In terms of recommendations, first one, coordinate an updated water and sewer rate study. Implementing a tiered rate, yeah, I think that we do need to do the updated water and sewer study. Tiered rates may be a useful tool for us, although I think that two things that really must happen is there has to be common terms. When you look at that water bill, gee, how many gallons per day am I using? It can't take math, so we have to get to the point where someone can just look and be able to determine that quickly. Once you know what you're using, then that's the first step in using less. But if it's an abstract figure, we're never going to get people to conserve water. Secondly, I think any tiered rate has to take into consideration size of family, a lot of different things. So when we get to that, we're going to have to look long, hard, and carefully at exactly what's part of the tiered rate. The groundwater study, absolutely. I'd like to have hard data in front of me that says this is what we've got, this is what we're using, this is where we're going. So anything that puts real, hard scientific data in our hands, I think, is useful. So I will support a groundwater study. Nasa Meadow water supply option, surely. Let's see what's out there. And if we tie it with the Price Canyon oil field and being able to use that water for 10 years and then being able to transition into using the same link to help get the water to be treated, then that's fine too. I think that's worth considering. Desal kind of surprised me. I thought that was a real expensive option that wasn't even worth looking at. But if it is, by all means, let's examine that and see what's going to cost us. Most of the costs for these most of the funding for these projects looks to be shared with other cities and in relatively small numbers. So I think that will be an investment worth making for the city. I just find it hard to get my hands around the fact that reclaimed water, we have so much of it that's going to be there that there's no use for it. There's no way to use that water. And I think maybe we have to look outside the box and see if maybe there are. Can reclaimed water be used to recharge aquifers? Well, maybe we use it to do that. I don't know. It just seems if there's that much water, it's going to be available there. Maybe there's a way to make it useful or find someone that can use it. Seems like a waste to just pour it in the ocean. But I think a lot of good work here.
And expanding and clarifying the recommendations that you have up there, that all of that is going to be incorporated in a comprehensive effort on the part of staff to move forward. An example being the things that Tom mentioned about state water, the things that I brought up with regard to continuing to front burner the Price Canyon.
I think we're comfortable with that, and I didn't hear any disagreement amongst council members on any of those
items. And the retrofit and all of the other comments and areas of focus that might go into more specific detail and have influence on the recommendations as they're currently written. So I just want to make sure that nothing's lost based on the discussion that has taken place here in expanding these recommendations accordingly. And then the only other, I guess I'll throw it out as an admonishment, is that there are so many of these
strategies, if you will, that do involve other jurisdictions. And that's going to mean, I think, probably some extra effort on staff, staff's part, and certainly between city managers, to the degree that the council can assist in discussing some of these key issues with other councils. I think that's something that we'd all be willing to do, particularly on some of the more meaty issues and the higher cost, high ticket items that involve you know, this communal contribution to getting these things done. So to the extent that we need to exchange data, obtain data from PISMO, if we need to work with Grover and PISMO on joint funding, the degree to which the council can run interference, if that's something that you need us to do, I think we'd be more than willing to do that. But again, some of these costs that you're proposing are based on the fact that they will be shared. And so we need to make sure that really happens, that we do have interjurisdictional buy-in in many of these strategies.
We'll be coming back with the actual allocations in terms of what we get.
So with that understanding, then I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I would move that we accept staff recommendations as presented on I got to get the right situation here. But anyway, that to move forward with the recommendations that staff presented with A, B, C, and D of the attachment, and to include the retrofit Plains oil field water and state water in that for consideration. Does that pretty well cover it?
I think so. Anything else? Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second the motion.
Discussion? Okay, hearing none. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. We're going to take just a quick 5-minute break. So, council is back in session. That will take us to item 11A, consideration of adoption of an interim urgency ordinance establishing a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries. Good evening, Chief.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Before you have a, as you mentioned, an interim emergency ordinance to consider to establish a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries. In 1996, Prop 215 was passed, which basically amended the Health and Safety Code to allow for the use of medical marijuana. What it primarily did is it provided a defense to patients who were using medical marijuana, their caregivers, and physicians who may prescribe it. However, there were a lot of problems with the ordinance. It made a statement, but it gave very little direction. And the California State Senate under Senator John Vasconcellos established what was known as the Prop 215 Committee, which met for several years in an attempt to establish guidelines so they could come back and further amend the Health and Safety Code that would give us some solid guidelines on how to administer this law. In 2003, they passed SB 420, which unfortunately did not deal with a lot of the problems in terms of the ambiguities of the law, but did establish an ID card system for those who were patients that were using medical marijuana. And it required the State Department of Health to establish this program, and then it would then the local county departments of health to administer it. To date, the State Department of Health has not established the program. There are some counties that have gone out on their own and have established a program. San Luis Obispo County is not one of those. So basically, in this county right now, we have no system that complies with SB 420. To complicate this is federal law, and that's contained in Title 21 of the United States Code, beginning with Section 801, and it basically prohibits, it's basically what the old California law was. It prohibits the possession, distribution, cultivation of marijuana in any shape or form. There are no exceptions. And that has caused quite a bit of consternation within law enforcement, within local government. There's been several court cases that have battled back and forth over the issue, to the point where the United States Supreme Court, to their credit, has taken jurisdiction and is hearing a case out of California, Ashcroft versus Raich. That case is expected to come down at least probably around June of next year. Hopefully the Supreme Court will come down with a definitive decision. There's one of three ways they could go. They can either rule that the state initiative is valid and is not in conflict with state, specifically dealing with medical marijuana dispensaries. If medical marijuana dispensaries were allowed to be established without appropriate regulations, such uses might be established in areas that would be contrary to the public good. It would be contrary to our general plan, zoning laws, and public safety and welfare issues. In fact, when Prop 215 was originally passed, we did have a couple of locations within the city where people attempted to establish what they called medical marijuana distribution points, and both of those were located in residential areas. We were able to take care of that particular problem. But again, right now, there is nothing in the city codes that would regulate this activity. So what you have before you are basically three different directions that the city can go. You can do the city can do nothing and wait out the Supreme Court decision, but at the same time, we would have nothing that would on the books that would control the establishment of these locations. The second thing we could do is establish rules and regulations concerning zoning and that, and restrictions on where these locations could be permitted. Or the third thing we could do is adopt a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries. Cities have done all three. In fact, there are some cities that have established in California that have established rules and regulations as far as permitting these. But since the Supreme Court has taken the case, more and more cities are adopting moratoriums. In fact, I believe last week the city of San Luis Obispo did the same. And the advantage of the moratorium is twofold. Number one, it'll give us time to look at the various alternatives that we could utilize should the Supreme Court turn around and support the validity of Prop 215. And obviously, it gives us it will give us time to see what the Supreme Court does, because that will become the law of the land. Under the government code, Section 65858, the city can adopt an urgency moratorium like this. It takes 4/5 vote of the council, in that there's one council member missing. It would take the affirmative vote of all four of you on the dais to initiate this. It would be valid for a 45-day period. At that time, upon notice and hearing, the council could extend the interim emergency ordinance for an additional 10 months and 15 days. So given the fact that the Supreme Court wouldn't be expected to rule until this spring or early summer, undoubtedly we would come back in 45 days and ask for a continuance of the moratorium. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Rick?
Mr. Mayor. Rick, I guess my question kind of revolves around, it's more of a global question, and you may or may not be able to address this specifically, but we're dealing in our ordinance this evening with the issue of the concept of a medical marijuana dispensary. And I guess the question that I have is
What is first my first part?
License in a hot second if they were to start distributing marijuana. That's one of the reasons the Supreme Court's taken jurisdiction of this case.
So from a law enforcement perspective, then it causes those individuals who may have prescriptions from doctors that allow them to use medical marijuana then to somehow gain that federally illegal substance for that purpose, then to locate in a non-structured environment at this particular time.
Correct. And you even mentioned something else. You said doctors prescribing. No doctor will prescribe it under what you and I think of as a prescription for the very same reason the federal regulations that doctors who prescribe controlled substances, again, are licensed by the federal government to do so. And if they were to prescribe something that they were prohibited from prescribing, they would lose that licensing. That was a major issue in this Prop 215 committee I mentioned earlier, because one of the things we law enforcement wanted to see in that was a prescribing system. We wanted to see the triplicate prescription, and doctors absolutely refused to do it because they would be in violation of federal law.
I was discussing this issue with my wife, who's a RN, and I asked her, are there patients in the hospital that actually that she's aware of that utilize medical marijuana? And her comment was is that she believes that there are patients that are using medical marijuana in the pill form. What's the difference?
Well,
and it's not
there is a legally prescribed drug, which is basically the active ingredient, the cannabis. Don't ask me to pronounce the term. I forgot how. But the active ingredient can be prescribed in a legally, in a medication form. It is there. It has been for years. That's one of the issues that came up in terms of Prop 215 itself, where people were saying, well, I need to smoke the stuff. Well, the drug is available. It can be prescribed. Marijuana in its raw form for smoking purposes is illegal.
Okay. So I guess from the perspective now, I mean, we're really dealing from a law enforcement issue. It creates, from a local jurisdiction, creates a huge unknown out there as to one how. I mean, we know it's not regulated. We know that both the state health department and the counties is not performing the requirements that were put forth in the state law. And so from a local jurisdiction, you are having the potential is for us to get into a situation that would be extremely difficult for us to monitor until further information
is actually addressed. Beyond that, there have been cities, and I'll use Oakland, for example, and I think Berkeley, where cannabis clubs, I guess you can call them, have been established for the purpose of distribution of medical marijuana. And without the regulations that we talked about earlier, there's nothing to prohibit where they're established. They could be established anywhere.
Regulations at that time.
I noticed that as part of our ordinance that we're going to be looking at directing staff to look at the aspects and issues and develop the legislation to regulate and locate the medical marijuana dispensaries in a manner that will minimize the impacts of this community. So that's going to be part of what we're going to be looking at. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's the intent. If the Supreme Court comes down with a decision saying it's legitimate and then whatever guidelines it gives, we would then be coming back to the council with those regulations. If the Supreme Court turns around and says basically this federal law is supreme, then the issue becomes moot.
Thank you.
If I could just add
questions on the staff report.
I have a question. It seems pretty clear right now, Chief, that we're dealing with conflict between federal law and state law. Now, let's, for the sake of argument, assume that in June the Supreme Court says that state law dominates. Do we move into an issue where it's going to be a county regulation issue set up, or is that all up in the air until such time as we know?
It would be, I think, and again, I'll defer to the manager and the city attorney, but
each community can come back with its regulations. There's nothing at this point in time that prohibits that. There is no law, there's no decisional law on that. So, again, it would be, as the city manager stated, it would be a zoning issue. Where would it be if we had to have it? If the law of the land is that it is legitimate, that it that these distribution centers can be established. And by the way, there is nothing yet in law. There's an interpretation by some that says said that SB 420 allows distribution. But if you read the act, it does not. And but the fact is, there's got to be some type of distribution program. And that's right now, I think that's going to come back on the cities. Very similar to, again, what we have to deal with in the adult entertainment area. Where's an appropriate area of the city in terms of zoning and that to locate these types of facilities should the Supreme Court come back and say it's legitimate? And that's what we would come back to you with.
Thank you.
I wanted to underscore something. Although we're waiting for the Supreme Court case, this Ashcroft-Reich case, the basis of the interemergency ordinance is not simply waiting for the Supreme Court to make a decision. It's giving the staff an opportunity while that case is pending and while we have an urgency ordinance in place to study the issue, to develop operational criteria, to develop zoning regulations, so that when and if this does happen, when and if the Supreme Court does make a ruling that allows medical marijuana dispensaries, we have these things in place. As a matter of fact, we would like to have those things in place. We would like to have at least the ability to bring them forward before then. So we can't really just sit back and wait until the Supreme Court acts. The basis of the ordinance is to give staff that opportunity to study the issue before someone walks in the door with an application to establish one.
I guess I would concur. Even if we were to play out the scenario that Councilmember Costello was talking about a second ago, based on what you just said, I don't see the state of California coming.
Yeah, absolutely, that will be one of the options.
So, anyway, this is not a public hearing, but if there are members of the audience who would like to come forward and comment on 11A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. No takers? Okay. Close. Public comment. Bring this back. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think the issue of medical marijuana is a legitimate one for our society to deal with. Majority of the citizens of California voted in favor of this. However, right now, this does come back to basic conflict between state and federal law. And absent some sort of clarification, I think that it's a prudent measure to take this time. Put the moratorium in place and let staff go ahead and wrestle with some of the issues and come back with some clear-cut recommendations that we can take action on. I think that that's the right thing to do at this time.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Runnels?
I think we're on the right track with this, Mr. Mayor, and I'm not in favor of a marijuana situation regardless of what form it's in. So I think that having this interim ordinance, urgency ordinance to put a stop to it right now is a thing to do.
Councilmember Dickens.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, I think it's appropriate. It's one of these issues that we typically until it comes before us, we don't look at all the ramifications. And I appreciate the chief bringing this before us so that we can kind of better understand all the ramifications, one from a zoning standpoint and from, how it's going to be regulated and, again, the laws that are unknown. But I think it's important for us to look at in this interim period all of these aspects, where, when, if, or if at all, it's appropriate for medical marijuana dispensaries. I think that certainly the public, both from a federal level, state level, and of course locally, is going to be concerned about what it looks like, how it's going to be maintained. I, for one, would you know, think if there's benefits, then it should be regulated like any other prescription drugs. That would make it a heck of a lot easier. But obviously, that's not the scenario in which we're working under today. Unfortunately, it puts an undue burden on our local jurisdictions, and I think from both a law enforcement standpoint, how do we deal with that, and then from a zoning standpoint, once we figure these things out, how are we going to deal with it as a community issue, would serve us well to take a step back, initiate the interim ordinance or the emergency ordinance. To give us time to then reflect on all these issues. So I, for one, am in favor of moving forward with the ordinance as presented.
Thank you. I think this has all the potential for a tremendous, for lack of a better term, Pandora's box. When you look at the presence in our community and lead toward the potential for these substances getting in the wrong hands. So I'm in favor of this moratorium with a view towards putting some stringent procedures in place in the city and not looking towards establishing distribution points. This is something that you just can't get your arms around after, I don't know how the chief feels, but after over 20 years in law enforcement, there's absolutely no way that you can legally regulate and control these kinds of things. All you do is increase the inventory and the temptation for abuse in your community, and I'm not in favor of it. So, with that, I will entertain a motion here.
Mr. Mayor, I would move that the City Council adopt an interim urgency ordinance of the City of Aurora Grandy establishing a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Roll call.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. We got our 4/5.
We did want to note that we'll be bringing this back on the first of the December 14th meeting because it's only in place for 45 days, and the first January meeting will be too late to extend it.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, that takes us to item number 12, City Council Reports. And I guess I'm first up with Slocog and Slorda. Had some interesting activity at the Slocog meeting. I think as far as Council of Governments goes, the headliner was the new train that we have serving the Central Coast, the Surfliner, and took its maiden voyage, if you will, I guess, on the 17th, and there was a big promotional that ran through Grover and into San Luis Obispo. I don't know if anyone had a chance to ride that train. It was the inauguration ceremony. And at any rate, it's an increased rail service that will serve San Luis Obispo, Grover Beach, and down to Los Angeles and down to San Diego. And it's quite a nice train. It was a collaboration between Slocog, RTA, Caltrans, and Amtrak. One of the other things that we discussed at Slocog was the 2004 Regional Transportation Plan for San Luis Obispo County. It's called Vision for 2025. It's quite an informative document. I don't know, did we get copies of this, Steve? Okay, what I will do is leave this with you for distribution, put it in the council boxes, and share it with staff. And so they listened to the complaints and recommendations and suggestions of the community and incorporated it in
some expanded service, which I think is going to serve us well. So I'll leave this with folks as well. Let's see, South County San District, I believe Councilmember Dickens attended that meeting, so he'll give that report. Integrated Waste Management met. And a couple of things happened. We, first of all, we reviewed the work plan for the coming year. And pretty much the same. One of the things that that was sort of dovetailing into my comment at the last meeting about taking another look at our commercial recycling. And I got your message, Steve, that we were going to, that IWMA was going to commission their employee that does this for the cities to come through and work with some of our small businesses and make sure that we get back on track and that our recycled bins are inside locations. And that was one of the goals for the coming year was commercial recycling and making sure that we sort of keep a fire lit under our recycling effort. One of the other things, a positive note, and we don't know for certain yet, but we've submitted to the California Integrated Waste Management Board another authorization, and it's a request to establish the 2003 IWMA base year. And if they go along with the reason and rationale behind the application, then we can look at the potential for our diversion rate to be the highest that it's ever been, up to 63%, recognizing that AB 929 only required a 50%. So that would be a tremendous positive note for the IWMA's effort. Let's see, I do have some other items that I will mention under council communication. And that concludes my report for now. And Mayor Pro Tem is not here. So, Councilmember Reynolds, you're up next.
Okay. Well, we had our bi-monthly Zone 3 meeting, and everything is going according to Hoyle. The recreation area is reporting good fishing since the Lopez Lake has got the longest runway at the present time so that the fishing game truck can get down and deliver fish. So they're dumping extra fish here because they got fish, so they've been doing pretty well with the fishing. The revenues are about static from what they were in the last year at this time as far as the recreation report goes. The construction of the restroom that had been burnt down at the marina is well underway, and I think they're figuring on having it done early in January if things go according to Hoyle. The lake is approximately still underway. They're checking to see which membrane is going to work the best and get the right formulation down, and we're moving forward with that. So everything is kosher at the lake at this point in time. I think I distributed this letter that I got from Cacho last time where he had written a letter to the State Coastal Conservancy supporting the Santa Lucia Resource Conservation District effort to get matching funds of $150,000 to study the Rio Grande Creek. So that's all in progress, and whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. And I was out of town for the RAC meeting, so I didn't get there. That's it.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. My first report will be on the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. I attended the November 13th meeting, and just a couple of quick updates. First of all, the plant continues to maintain all its discharge requirements. The plant is currently going through we've taken down what's called our Digester 1, which is our large tank for the process for cleaning. And with our staff being proactive down there, they went out and kind of notified the immediate residents because as they open up this digester, there may be some additional smells that may occur and so forth. But I think hopefully they've done a good educational blitz in regards to letting them know why there might be some minor changes in regards to some impacts in that particular area. But hopefully within the next 3 months we'll get the Digester 1 back on line. As a result of the cleaning, though, the plant has seen some increases in some of our discharge, especially with the BODs, and we have enacted some interim measures to help maintain our discharge requirements. But staff is doing a great job down there, keeping that plant running smoothly. So that concludes my report for them. And I was able to attend the SCAT meeting as an alternative. Mayor Pro Tem Lubin has been out ill, so that particular meeting, my report basically includes the fact that we received our annual review, and SCAT continues to increase ridership month to month and year to year. This past fiscal cycle, we've actually seen ridership increase by 5.8%. And in addition, the SCAT continues to grow in the first 2 months of this new fiscal year by over 11%. So that's good news. We're getting more and more people out of their cars into public transportation. Just to highlight real quickly what the mayor talked about is that there is the regional Route 10, and that specifically is going to add increased services from San Luis Obispo to Santa Maria area, increasing some specific areas in the Napomo area, which is an unmet need, and I think that's real important for those travelers. So certainly we're...
Thank you. Councilmember Costello.
Well, the normal APCD bimonthly meeting would have been scheduled for tomorrow, but we had to postpone it until next Wednesday. So I wouldn't have had anything to report tonight anyway, but it's going to be held next week, and then hopefully the next meeting I'll have something to report. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. That takes us to item 13, City Council Member Items. There is one item this evening, a request of the council to appeal the Planning Commission's approval of Condition 17 regarding the undergrounding of overhead utilities for conditional use permit 1490 East Grand Avenue, Gills Market. This is related to the facade improvement grant that we approved some time ago for Gills Market to try and dress up that corner. This has been a kind of a touchy situation all the way through the process, and I think our goal here, if we step back from it, our interim goal is to make that corner look as nice as we can as an interim measure. And so there were some issues regarding, I guess, the undergrounding of utilities and the permitting and the fees attached with that process. That the Planning Commission took issue with, and so what I'd like to do is bring this back and have us hear it at a future meeting as soon as possible, as soon as we can get it agendized and review this. Any problem with that?
No problem.
Okay. That takes us to item 15, Council Communication. Do you have any? Any?
Christmas parade?
Yeah, do you want to make a comment? I have a couple of items here under council communication. Do you have anything you want to mention about the Christmas parade, Steve?
Actually, our chief probably has more information. I have the date. I don't have the... Do you have the times? And
Sunday.
4 o'clock.
Yes.
5.
5 to 7, maybe?
You're saying you have breaks now?
We have breaks.
Thanks.
I think we just need to know that it's happening.
It's happening.
This Sunday.
Believe me, it's happening.
And
I'm not really sure how much of
a report you want, but we've actually been working quite diligently over the last week or so to get this put together. It's going to be larger than it has in the past, and that's the reason you had the agenda item that you had on, under the consent calendar, because we have gone to Caltrans to close Branch Avenue between Mason down to Traffic Way for the parade. I did meet with one of the members of the committee this afternoon, and apparently they were having their final meeting tonight to finalize all that. But I understand there's somewhere around 30 plus or minus entrants. I'm hearing there may be 30 plus, and I'm trying to work on that issue right now. However, again, it looks it's happening. The committee is quite energetic, and I'm
okay.
No, check. By the way, I didn't mention it, and the manager just reminded me. It does start at it goes between 5 and 6. So, okay. And then there is the tree lighting right afterwards, which is
right.
The actual real purpose of the parade.
Right. So that will be the aftermath, will be the tree decorating across the street in front of City Hall.
Correct.
Refreshments, I guess. They're going to have eggnog and things like that. And then also,
eggnog.
I guess the following Saturday is the Grover Beach Parade. And I guess it's Councilmember Costello and myself that will be in that as well.
And I'm going to be out of town.
Right. So we'll be represented in Grover Beach. And transportation along the parade route is yet to be determined, I understand, but forthcoming from the fire department.
Aren't you going to take a tractor down there, too?
We have a time on that one yet?
I think it's 10 o'clock in the morning is when that takes off.
That was early morning deal, wasn't
it? Yeah, and I'm not I think the tractor's already going to be in that parade, so I think we're going to be stuck on a piece of fire apparatus, but not the big ladder truck. Okay. Does that answer your clarify all the parade information for you?
That'll be wonderful. Thank you.
Okay,
looking
good.
Forward to that.
All right. A couple of items of council communication, and Rick, it's a good thing you're sitting up here. In our packets, we got I think at least two letters from residences regarding speed survey and change of potential changing of speed limits. There's one on from Via Las Aguilas. Was talking about speed limit increase on Rancho Parkway, and then also another one on Wasna. So is this something that can you shed some light on this process? Or
I can shed some light on it, yes. Actually, the city engineer is the one that's responsible for this. Surveys are done, at which time, if we had to make a modification to a survey or a speed limit, it would be brought to the city council for action. So it's not something we can really discuss, except that's what the process is. The city engineer goes through what's called a traffic safety and engineering study, where they look at the speed limits, that's your survey, they look at the accident history, they look at engineering issues. Then he has to make a determination as far as what the recommended speed limit is within the Caltrans guidelines, and he brings that forward, which you certify. The good news is some of these that we thought were expiring, we found a way that we may be able to extend them for another 2 years. But that's something, again, we're working on, and I really can't get into an in-depth discussion of that tonight.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to, you know, bring to the council's attention that I didn't know where we were in this process as far as the concerns stated by the
correct
members of the community.
I have seen copies of those letters. We did have a town hall meeting 2 weeks ago where we discussed this, some of the issues, and we're working on ways to mitigate that within the law. As you well know, the law is very stringent in terms of speed traps, speed surveys,
Is that something that we're aware of? There's money here that we can apply for to do our hazard mitigation studies and put our plan in place. And there are also some timelines in here as well that we have to make sure our grant applications are processed before certain dates. Is that working, or
We have an individual in the fire department that's been diligently researching those grant possibilities, and I think we have a meeting set up next week with myself, representatives from fire and police, to start coordinating how we can proceed on that.
Okay. Again, this is local government. This money that's supposed to earmark to go out to local government to assist us with our planning costs. So I'll leave that in the stack for you as well. I don't know if you've seen it or not. And then last, certainly not least, last week I attended a two-day seminar down in actually a workshop down in Newport Beach. It was sponsored by the League of Cities. It was the League Leaders Conference. It was for the Board of Directors. The chief was down there sitting in, as a board member. And also for policy committee chairs and for division officers. So I was there representing Channel Counties and also as the chair of the Public Safety Policy Committee for the League. And during the process, one of the tasks, I guess, for the board with input from some of the other league leaders was to formulate the goals for the league. Now that the dust has settled from Prop 1A, the league is looking to focus on other issues. And one of the things that that came forward was, as pretty much the primary goal, was to look at the whole housing issue for California. And which is a good thing. The not-so-good thing, I think, was the draft that they came out with. I've got a lot of concerns about it. I intend to raise those concerns at the Channel Counties meeting. And I also have I also want to raise it at our next mayor's meeting as well. And recognizing that this is a draft, there are some red flags in here that relate to pretty much permits issued by right into the future and pretty much locking in zoning and density. And then there's also the concerns about how CEQA weaves in and out of this process. So I will leave the stack here for us to take a look at. Again, recognizing that this is draft, I'm just a little bit concerned about the enthusiasm of the league right now as they are approaching this process. That's not to say that we don't need to have it work through and that it isn't going to be a lingering issue with us. But I believe we've already gotten a good start with this process through begin to chime in early on in this process. So I'll leave that in the stack as well. There's several copies here. Okay. Any other council communication? Staff communication?
I just wanted to remind the council and announce to the public that the council reorganization meeting is on Monday, December 6th at 6:30 p.m. here in the council chambers. So it'll be a specially scheduled meeting.
Okay. Yeah, we'll be seating the new council and new city clerk and treasurer, and refreshments will be served. So everyone is welcome. Okay, that takes us to item 17, community comments and suggestions, an opportunity for any member of the audience to come forward and discuss or present any item. Okay, no takers. Close item 17 and motion to adjourn. Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
6:30 on the 6th.